Hello, I'm Alan Saunders. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. Now, philosophy, like any other discipline, has its sub-disciplines. There's ethics, aesthetics, metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of mind, philosophy of politics, philosophy of language, or philosophy of just about anything you care to mention, actually. And among these is philosophy of science. What's that, then? Well, to find out, we're joined now by Dr. Peter Slezak, Senior Lecturer in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of New South Wales. Peter, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thanks, Alan.
Now, Peter, you, as I said, are in a School of History and Philosophy of Science, and perhaps we can talk later about what history's got to do with it. Now, this perhaps suggests that your job is to put scientific work into a metaphysical context, or perhaps to clarify the concepts involved. I, on the other hand, did my graduate work in the area at a place calling itself a Department of Logic and Scientific Method. This suggests that we wanted actually to tell scientists how to go about their work, what methods they should be using. So what is it that philosophers of science do actually do?
It's interesting that you describe it as perhaps putting science into some sort of metaphysical context. I'd say that that's precisely what they're not doing anymore, at least. Metaphysics has become a kind of rude word in philosophy of science. I mean, it's used in all sorts of ways, but certainly since David Hume, I suppose, and around that time, metaphysics was precisely what they were trying to distinguish from science. The idea was to find what's distinctive about science that makes it respectable intellectually, and it's to be contrasted with all sorts of other claims for knowledge that are just illegitimate. And certainly Hume's tradition and his program was picked up in the 30s by the so-called logical positivists or empiricists, and they were very explicitly anti-metaphysical and very hostile against philosophers like that.
Well, they said they were, but I actually meant metaphysics in the sense of some coherent logical picture of the world, not necessarily something that goes wildly, religiously and mystically beyond our experience.
Yes, but the coherent overall picture of the world is just what science is supposed to be telling us. And I think the most widely held view today is that there just is nothing other than that scientific picture. Science exhausts what is reasonable and warranted.
But that doesn't answer the question. What are philosophers of science doing?
Well, in a way, it does answer the question, because nowadays, at least, philosophers of science, many of them, certainly in America, regard themselves as just part of the scientific tradition itself, doing science, armchair science, perhaps, if not in the lab. And that, in a way, is part of the scientific enterprise itself. So perhaps they're clarifying some of the questions about the nature of science. In philosophy of physics, for example, which is not my own field, but there it's a kind of theoretical physics. In my own field of psychology and what used to be called philosophy of mind, it's really arguing about the implications of the existing theories in, let's say, psychology or neuroscience or in artificial intelligence, where they're trying to figure out what one can say about the mind within what is essentially the scientific program.
Is there any reason why this should be done by people in philosophy departments or philosophy of science departments? I mean, I don't want to get too much into where the academic or disciplinary boundaries are, but why can't scientists who spend most of their time doing what we would think of as real scientific work, why can't they do this sort of thing for themselves?
That's a good question. It depends on the discipline. They can, except that they often read some philosophy of science, and, for example, they regard themselves often as Popperians who are running around trying to falsify their theories, which scientists actually don't do. In the area of psychology, I think it's fair to say that they get trained in certain ways, for example, which I think discourages them from thinking about some broader questions. I'm thinking of specific debates I've had an interest in, where, in fact, the scientists themselves are exceedingly naive about some of the theoretical disputes they get into. They're trained to be experimentalists and think of evidence somehow as proving their theories. And a lot of the debates within psychology itself, for example, are conducted by philosophers that can take a step backwards a little bit and been trained a little bit differently and see things in a broader perspective. But it's not essentially different.
Perhaps we could tease out the point about scientists thinking of themselves as Popperians. Now, what this means is that they think of themselves as followers of the Anglo-Austrian philosopher Karl Popper, who died a little more than 10 years ago at a great age. Before Popper, this is actually a bit of the Popper myth of the history of philosophy, but we won't go into how much of a myth it is. But the Popper myth is that before him, scientists were encouraged in the tradition of Francis Bacon, the 17th century English philosopher, just to go around collecting facts. And once you've got enough facts, you can start making a theory out of them. And Popper observed that however many facts you've got, the next one might contradict the theory that you built up out of them. And the famous one is you decide that all swans are white, and then you go to Western Australia, whoops, a black swan, yes, definitely a swan and definitely black. There goes my scientific theory that all swans are white. Therefore, Popper said, scientists, instead of trying to confirm their theories, should try to come up with bold hypotheses which can be falsified. And that's the way science advances, by trying to falsify theories. Now, you say that scientists call themselves Popperians, but in fact they're not really trying to do what Popper said they should be trying to do. And I suppose my question there would be, does that matter? I mean, because are we not there talking about the logical status of their theories and the way in which they actually work? Is it important to an understanding of the logical status of the conclusions of their work?
Well, there are two different things. It doesn't matter from the point of view of the science itself. Scientists do their science. What we're talking about is understanding the nature of the scientific enterprise. And the scientists themselves often reflect badly and naively on the nature of the enterprise as distinct from what they're actually doing. Incidentally, I should say that it comes up today in the debate about intelligent design. A lot of the scientists who I think are on the right side of this and want to discredit intelligent design often do it with naive statements about the nature of science and how they want to distinguish something that's perhaps beyond the pale. But even within the realms of respectable scientific discourse, they often say things that are just not the case. So, for example, famously, historians like Thomas Kuhn showed that scientists actually aren't running around open-mindedly trying to discredit or falsify their own theories. They're committed to a certain framework and they run around trying to find evidence to support it. And so, in practice, science works quite differently from what the scientists themselves may say when they reflect on it, as distinct from what they're doing in the lab.
But if then we want to understand the nature of the scientific enterprise, surely we don't need philosophers. We need historians and sociologists, don't we?
Well, I don't know about the sociologists. I've had my doubts about the sociologists. They've had a lot of, I think, harmful influence on the debates in recent times. The science wars are an example of, I think, extreme nonsense that can be said about science. But leaving the sociologists out of it, I think that the historians and the philosophers do have a lot to offer which the practicing scientist doesn't. So, for example, I've been recently interested in the Galileo affair, and it's very interesting to look at that from a historical point of view and how it bears on contemporary debates about the nature of science and the nature of explanations and all sorts of things which a practicing scientist isn't necessarily good at doing. They're good at doing their science but not reflecting on the nature of it. For example, what counts as an explanation? What counts as a theory? These things have been traditional and very difficult questions to answer. Which is not to say, as Hume himself realised, we don't have to stop science until the philosophers figure out what's going on. But these are nevertheless deep and quite difficult questions, in a sense quite separate from the actual practice of the science.
Now, you've said that in the United States, philosophers of science think of themselves as part of the scientific enterprise. Was there a reason why you said in the United States? Is it different in other parts of the English-speaking world?
Yes, I think it is. At least in my particular area of interest, the philosophy of mind or philosophy of psychology, the philosophers, some of them at least, writing in England, talk about their enterprise. In one case, for example, Colin McGinn, a very distinguished philosopher, I think he's actually in America now, but he talks about his enterprise as antecedent to and independent of science. I have no idea what that means, and a lot of philosophers trained in America don't understand how anything could be antecedent to science, as if they're telling the scientists what to do, which is roughly what the philosophers think they may be able to do. And it's not clear that that makes any sense at all.
This has a long and distinguished history, this view of things, though, doesn't it? John Locke, in the late 17th century, describes himself as an under-labourer. So you get the picture of him sweeping the path clean before the scientists, or the natural philosophers, as they would have called them then, sort of come across.
Yes, that was his own metaphor, but he prefaced that remark and he said he'd be satisfied to be the under-labourer by saying there are the great geniuses like Newton and the great Huygens, and he said that he's satisfied if he can clear the rubbish away, as you say. But that's not necessarily antecedent to science. That's clarifying some of the confusions that can enter into scientific reasoning. I think that's still important, particularly in areas like psychology, but perhaps in philosophy of physics as well. There's lots of conceptual issues that philosophers, so long as they're well informed by the science, can reflect on.
They need the maths, do they?
In philosophy of physics, they certainly do. Again, you can't do philosophy of science unless you are as well schooled and well trained in the science that's relevant. Nowadays, that's what's changed since, I suppose, the British tradition. When the philosophy of science, in large part, moved to America after the war, the idea that you could do philosophy just in the armchair, puffing on your pipe and reflecting on the English language, that changed and you had to become well informed. And the best work is now done by people who are independently very well qualified, of course, in the sciences, as they must be.
Although it should be said that some of the European emigres who worked in England after the war, Karl Popper, one of them, Imre Lakatos, another one, Stefan Kuhn, Kuhner, I think they could do more than simple sums.
Yes, indeed. And of course, that's why they made such important contributions. They were profoundly well informed about the nature of science or mathematics, and that was the model that has been continued.
So here you all are, you philosophers of science, paying all this attention to science and what scientists do. And do you get any thanks for it? Is your love reciprocated? Why do so many scientists, the late Richard Feynman is one example, Lewis Wolpert is another one, why do they seem to hold philosophy in such low regard?
Goodness, I didn't know that was quite the case, but maybe it is. It probably depends on the sort of philosophy, and maybe they had an earlier view of philosophy, perhaps depending on these a priorists, these people that presumed to tell scientists how to do their work. I'm not sure that that's the case, but if it is, it depends on the sorts of philosophy they have in mind. I think nowadays philosophers work so closely within the framework of science, as I'm saying, that there wouldn't be grounds for criticism. In the philosophy of biology, for example, they're speculating about the nature of biology with biologists, and they work hand in glove with the scientists, and so I'm not sure that that's quite fair.
Well, I'm presuming, of course, that the trade in affection is one way only, but perhaps there's no affection either way. Some philosophers of science, or people calling themselves philosophers of science, do actually seem to be rather anti-science, don't they?
Well, again, it depends on what you mean by philosophers, and this is obviously a very broad field. There is a whole tradition in Europe, the continental tradition, which is either contemptuous of science or is not interested in it. There are other people who have pretensions to doing philosophy of science, the sociologists we've mentioned. They are, on the whole, I think, pretty ignorant of science, and they certainly are hostile to science. The science wars has erupted largely because of what are, I think, ill-informed criticisms of science from sociologists who have these epistemological and philosophy of science pretensions. And they talk a lot of rubbish, and a lot of destructive rubbish as well.
You work, as I said, in a department of the history and philosophy of science. There are quite a few of these around, but why should there be? You will no doubt find the odd philosopher in a law department, but we don't have departments of the history and philosophy of law. So what is it with history and philosophy of science that brings them together?
It may just be a historical accident. It's been a distinct area of interest, and it's very broad and perhaps central to philosophy. I mean, epistemology, the philosophy of knowledge, the nature of knowledge was always the central discipline in philosophy, and philosophy of science is really just an outgrowth and a broadening of that interest in the nature of knowledge.
But how is this illuminated by the study of history? Why can't that be done in history departments?
Well, historians, generally speaking, of course, are not trained to be historians of science, so you have to be particularly interested in science, and the best history of science is done by people who understand Isaac Newton or understand Galileo's work, and so you have to have a scientific training. The best history of science is done by people who also understand the science intimately. The history of science tells you things about the nature of science which you can reflect on in a way that you can't perhaps in the contemporary context. For example, the nature of scientific revolutions is the classic kind of problem. What happened with Galileo and with Isaac Newton or with Darwin? And of course, you have to have historians that can give you the rich detail that informs the current philosophy.
Well, Peter Slezak, thank you very much for informing us about current philosophy.
Thanks very much, Alan.
I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone. Meantime, stay tuned to ABC Radio National for Robin Williams and the programme that draws its title from a bit of medieval philosophy of science, Occam's Razor.
I think I've mentioned before in this programme that Jared Diamond has called agriculture our greatest mistake. If true, then it's one we made about 10,000 years ago. The argument will resurface here several times over the next few weeks. Today it's Duncan Brown, born in New Zealand, once with CSIRO, more recently Professor Emeritus in Biology at the University of Wollongong. His book, Feed or Feedback, has been praised by everyone from Lord May, President of the Royal Society of London, to John le Carré and Peter Singer. Professor Duncan Brown.
Every animal species has functional characteristics, behavioural as well as physiological, which contribute to its identification as a species. As well as unique manual dexterity, there are two behavioural characteristics of Homo sapiens that, in my opinion, have underpinned just about every impact we have had and are having on
Hello, and thanks for using ABC Online. We're currently having some technical difficulties with the media service you've requested, and for the moment we're unable to provide it. We apologise for this and hope you'll bear with us while it's being fixed. The service should be back online shortly, so please stay with us until then.